is Jenkins versus the Panama Canal Railroad Company. We're ready to hear from the petitioner.
Good morning. My name is James Peters. I appear in front of you here today. My attorney registration number is 15195. I represent the petitioners in this case. Herman Jenkins, Barbara Jenkins, Bonnie Bills, Travis Lowery Estes, and Nathaniel Estes, all of whom were Colorado residents at the onset of this case, four of whom are appearing here today who are still residents of the state of Colorado. This case arises from a train collision that occurred in the country of Panama. My clients had purchased cruise tickets from Charlotte's Cruises and Tours, and they were, at the time they purchased the tickets, they were showing cruise brochures or tour brochures of the Panama Rail Company, the train trip that they were going to take, and which they eventually signed up for when they got on the cruise line and took that trip. What we have here today, and the reason we're here today, is that we have two Colorado statutes that are in apparent conflict. That would be the borrowing statute and the Uniform Conflict of Loss Limitation Act, UCLA. Let me back up for a minute. We know that the Colorado statute of limitations, and this action was filed within the Colorado statute of limitations, is 2 years for tort actions. Panama, there's an allegation that there's a one-year statute of limitations for tort claims, and that could be true, but we don't know if that's even the accurate statute of limitations. It's a possibility.
Why is that?
Because it could have been a product liability that led to the cause of this collision, and we don't have the sufficient information because that information is not readily available coming out of the country of Panama. If there was a product, if the two trains hit on the track head on, if a switch had caused that, there would be potential product liability action, and we just don't know if that was the cause. The discovery today, I just don't know if that was the cause of why the trains collided head on, and if it was, then the Panamanian statute of limitations in that case is 10 years. Similarly, if any criminal charges had been filed out of that, and I don't know if there had been or not, Your Honor, but if there had been criminal charges, then the Panamanian statute of limitations would have been told. So we're not even sure as to which statute of limitations in Panama is applicable in this case. We do know that Colorado has a 2-year statute of limitations. Assuming for the sake of our argument that it is a 1-year statute of limitations, I think it's important to look at the legislative history of the two statutes and trying to determine which statute we're going to apply here.
Is there any factual basis for the Court of Appeals concluding then that the 1-year statute applies here and this complaint is out?
I don't think so.
What did the trial court do with that issue?
The trial court, we did not raise that as a defense that there was a wrong statute of limitations or that there was a tolling of the statute of limitations in the trial court. And the reason we didn't is they had stated as affirmative defense statute of limitations blank. They didn't say Panamanian statute of limitations. By the time that was raised, I had 15 days to file a response, and I do my research down here in the basement of the Supreme Court building, and unlike a sister state such as California, where I can readily pull up and take a look at their procedural law, it's not readily available here in this building, and it's not readily available online.
You mean the Panamanian law is not available?
Panamanian law, yes, correct. Not unlike California, a sister state, or Utah or New Mexico, Panamanian law is not readily available. And we did not discover this, as they pointed out in their briefs, we didn't discover this until this case was in the Court of Appeals. Under Rule 11, too, I couldn't have, without knowing that, I couldn't possibly have asserted that as a defense at the trial court, that the statute of limitations had either been told or that they were applying the wrong statute of limitations. We just can't get that information out of Panama.
Well, let me understand procedurally, though. There was a motion for summary judgment on the basis of you being past the statute of limitations, and that was granted. Is that right? And you didn't oppose it on the grounds that there was a factual dispute about which statute of limitations applied?
I didn't have any knowledge that a different one would apply at that point in time, because I couldn't find out that information. It wasn't online, and it wasn't, we don't have procedure books for Panama downstairs, and we didn't discover that. The Court of Appeals, when the attorney was helping me on it, called down there to Panama and finally got in touch with a Panamanian attorney to find out about the statute of limitations. And that's how we found out about it and brought it forth in front of the Court of Appeals.
Well, let me ask you just one more procedural question. You filed this case only as a negligence case, right?
True.
And even when there was a motion to dismiss based upon statute of limitations, you didn't take an opportunity to try to amend your complaint to allege products defect or criminal conduct or something else?
How could I do that?
Well, I understand that, but in any event, the record that we have before us is that this is a negligence case, 2-year statute in Colorado, 1 year in Panama, and nothing else, right?
Right, because under Rule 11, I couldn't say that there was a product liability defect if I didn't have that information or that report, and I can't get that information out of Panama.
Thank you.
Okay. So, I mean, there's a three-part, there's, getting back to the rules of statutory construction, there's a three-part analysis here. One, which is the later enacted statute. In this situation, 1921, the borrowing statute was enacted, and the reason, the purpose behind the borrowing statute was to prohibit forum shopping by non-resident plaintiffs, right? We don't have that situation here. My clients are residents of Colorado. In 1984, UCLA, or the Uniform Compass Limitations Act, was adopted, and that had a clause in there for 1382-106, which I did raise, which is an argument that was raised in the trial court, was that was applicable because the statute of limitations, it applies if the statute of limitations time period is substantially different from Colorado. And on that first issue on that is that it is substantially different. It's half of what Colorado's is. And the Colorado legislature, when they were debating, you know, putting in the statute of limitations, they thought that a 1 year tort statute of limitations was too short. So we meet that prong of the test. And the second prong of the test is whether in this, let's take the statute. If the substantially different from the limitation period of this state and has not afforded, the second part of that is not afforded a fair opportunity to sue upon, or in the alternative imposes an unfair burden in defending or prosecuting against the claim. Well, it would be, we would meet that. There's an unfair burden. Not only couldn't we find information on Panamanian law, but it imposes an unfair burden on having to have Colorado residents go down to the state of Panama to prosecute a claim when all their doctors, economists, and all their expert witnesses are up here, all the plaintiffs are up here, and one of the defendants at the time, Charlotte Haymore, was up here. Also, so I think we fall within that exception of 3282-106. Now, the issue is whether or not we can apply UCLA or whether we have to apply the borrowing statute. And I think the second prong of the test, I think the first prong of the test, if you look at the legislative history, and I'm not willing to concede that it's a later enacted statute, even though it was amended, borrowing statute was amended in 86 and reenacted because it was part of a legislative scheme taken in total.
I'm confused here. I guess, you know, and I'm going to ask a legislative history question, and that is, it does appear like the legislature did adopt more the conflict of law situation to apply for law of foreign jurisdictions, right? And that's the statute you're arguing.
Right.
They then, having repealed the Borrowing Act that would borrow from Panama its statute of limitations,
right,
they then reenacted for some reason. What I can't figure out is why they reenacted that, and why, when you're dealing with a conflicts of law statute like the one you're arguing, that isn't really the exclusive statute. So what possibly could be the purpose of the legislature reenacting the borrowing statute?
I think they threw that in there as part of the entire legislative scheme putting in their various limitations period, and I think they reenacted it. I don't think, and they didn't intend, and nor did they state that they were doing away with the conflict of laws statute. I think they reenacted it, and I think the legislative history is clear, to prevent forum shopping by non-residents, which again is not the situation we have here.
Well, let's just stop there one second. So what we're calling the borrowing statute was repealed in 1984, and the conflicts provision, the uniform conflicts provision, was passed. Now we have the borrowing statute reenacted 2 years later.
Correct.
Okay. Whatever they intended, is there some reason why the more recent statute, if these really are in conflict, what's the reason why the more recent statute shouldn't apply?
Well, I think the legislature wanted them to read in harmony, and I think the borrowing statute was reenacted to prevent forum shopping from non-residents, and I think UCLA, the Conflict of Limitations Act, I think it was installed to benefit Colorado residents, which is what we have here, and they threw in the unfairness provision to prevent situations like this where we've got a foreign country we're dealing with, as opposed to a sister state. I mean, they haven't repealed the specific statute. 3282-106 was never repealed by the legislature.
The borrowing statute seems pretty absolute on its face. Is there some way in which you read that to be ambiguous or to be able to be reconciled with the uniform law?
Well, I think if you track it and put it up against the UCLA, I think they're essentially the same statute except for that one specific provision. And I don't believe from looking through the legislative history that there was ever an intent to go back to a situation where Colorado residents would be denied access to Colorado courts based upon a statute of limitations that was clearly unduly burdensome.
Do you think that it's appropriate for us to look at the legislative history and go beyond the words of the statute unless somehow those words are ambiguous? And if so, then would you explain to us how they're ambiguous and we should go beyond them?
Well, I think because you have two statutes that are in conflict, you have to try to harmonize the statutes and look at them. I realize the borrowing statute says what it says on its face, but so does the Uniform Conflict of Law statute. And when UCLA was initially implemented, the borrowing statute was voided out. But conversely, when they reenacted the borrowing statute, they didn't throw out UCLA. UCLA, the Conflict of Law statute, stayed in and stayed as part of Colorado law.
And we have statute, right, that says if two statutes are in conflict and can't be reconciled, then the more recent effective date applies. So all of this is, so your rationale is dependent upon us being able to harmonize these two. Is that right?
Well, no. There's a three-prong analysis, and that's the first prong of the analysis. Mm-hmm. Second prong is which one is more specific, right? And the more specific statute, I submit to you, and I think the Colorado Court of Appeals got this wrong because they didn't do an analysis of it, but I think they just concluded that it was more specific, the borrowing statute, than the Uniform Conflict of Law statute. And the reason I think it's more specific is because both statutes apply to a general area of cases arising in another jurisdiction. But UCLA, or the Conflict of Law, has a specific statute, an escape clause, if you will, that provides for an instance where clients don't have a fair opportunity, or Colorado residents don't have a fair opportunity to pursue their claim in another jurisdiction. They don't have a fair opportunity, and also that the statute of limitations period is substantially different from the statute of limitations period in this case.
And so you're relying on the more specific versus general test for the reason why you should win, not because they can be harmonized?
I think there has to be an attempt to harmonize, and I think in order to harmonize, you have to read these statutes together. What are the differences between the statute, and why wasn't that UCLA overturned, as was in 1986 when borrowing statute was reenacted, as opposed to 1984, when the conflict of law statute was adopted and the boring statute was done away.
And I guess that's kind of what I'm asking. I'm looking for a little help on how we harmonize those two. And what I seem to hear you saying is not that the words of this statutes can be harmonized, but rather if we look at the history, we can understand why they made a mistake the second time around.
Yes,
and that's
exactly.
That's a way that counts as harmonizing. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
What's the gist of the unfair opportunity here? I mean, both statutes are on, you can find them. Is it just that Colorado practitioners are used to a two-year statute for negligence cases?
No, that's not it at all. The unfairness provision. For example, if this tort had occurred in California, California has a one-year statute of limitations, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to say my clients didn't have a fair opportunity to find out what that statute of limitations are, or that they didn't have a fair opportunity to sue in California, because I can walk downstairs, I can open up a California procedural book and familiarize myself with California procedural law. Can't do that in Panama. And that's where the unfairness statute kicks in. Not only is there a significant difference in the length of the time period of the statute of limitations, but also you have to look at the next aspect of it. Do they have a fair opportunity to sue in Panama, or would it be unduly burdensome to sue in Panama? And on both counts, the answer to that is yes.
Well, now, why isn't the answer is that immediately in contemplating filing a complaint, you or your client should have consulted a Panamanian lawyer regarding the statute of limitations. This incident occurred in Panama. Are you saying that we should be ignorant of all foreign law, basically, because the Colorado Supreme Court doesn't supply the access to Panamanian law?
No,
that sounded like your argument.
No, I'm just saying it was difficult to determine what that was, even at an early stage. And as they state in their brief, I sent off letters to the Panamanian Rail Company notifying them of the claim so that they would be aware of
that. Was within the one-year statute you did that?
Yeah, I did notify them within the 1 year of the potential claim that was out there. They, of course, did not tell me what they had a one-year statute of limitations, but they never raised that when they responded. They asked me for information on my client's treatment and information on my client's medical bills, but that's all that they requested from me when I went down there. And then, I made the argument, unsuccessful argument in the district court, that the genesis of this claim actually arose in Colorado, because that's where they purchased their cruise tickets from.
But the record is now clear. There was some back and forth in the brief that they purchased the train ride actually on the cruise ship when it was in Panama.
Well, yeah, and I think you're getting into jurisdictional arguments, which are not necessarily in front of us. But what actually happened is that you purchase a cruise on a cruise through an agency in here, and you purchase from them the actual cruise trip. But as Charlotte's name says, cruise and tours. Every time you purchase a cruise, they provide you with brochures on various tours. And part of the enticement for my clients to get on this cruise was the fact that they were going to take a train trip, which they thought would be safe in the country of Panama. And through no fault of theirs, two trains collided head on, and the conductor was killed, and my clients were injured. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Dana Eismeyer from Burns, Feagin, and Will, here representing the Panama Canal Railroad Company, Kansas City Southern Railway, and the estate of Stephen O'Donnell. As Mr. Peters has mentioned, this is a statutory construction case. I think it's a straight-up statutory construction case. I have disputes about some of the facts with Mr. Peters, but I don't think that's relevant to our discussion today. I think the record before this court is clear, based upon the trial court decisions and what was appealed and not appealed. We're talking about a one-year statute of limitations in Panama. We're talking about a trial court decision that the case arose in Panama. There was no appeal of the trial court's decision that the case arose in Panama. Rather, the appeal is focused on that the trial court applied the wrong statute and so on. But the record for our purposes today is pretty straight up. And in fact, as I see it, this case, unlike some of the prior cases, such as the RTD versus Boss case, Dawson versus Ryder, Jones v. Cox, and those cases which we'll talk about today, this case involves two mechanisms to pick out a statute of limitations. There isn't a huge policy going with them, such as with the no-fault statute or statutes involving governmental limitations and so forth. Here we're left with three factors, which were set out clearly by this court in RTD versus Voss, and those factors have been used over and over in decisions by this court since. Three factors are more recent statutes govern over older statutes, more specific statutes govern over more general statutes, and as a rule of last resort, based upon this court's ruling in BP America versus Patterson approximately a year ago, if the first two statutes don't apply, you look to the longer statute of limitations, because that's fairer. And in fact, that was the rationale that the court relied upon in RTD versus Voss. Now, I'd like to discuss those three factors, because I think that's where the heart of this case is.
Mr. Satchmeyer, can I ask you just a preliminary question?
Yes.
How was the proof of the Panama law proved in the trial court? How was proof of the one-year statute of limitations in Panama proven in the trial court?
I believe in the trial court decision, the actual statute is cited. I believe there was no argument from the plaintiffs that there was any tolling or anything along those lines. So that issue, if there was an issue, was not preserved. The one-year, the record which went to the Court of Appeals and the opinion of the trial court is that there's a one-year statute. I can get the Court of Appeals opinion, but I believe it's cited in there, the exact Panama statute. I would also point out that, as Mr. Peters acknowledged, that he'd been in contact with Panama Canal Railroad Company in Panama 7 months before this case, before the one-year statute ran, and the trial court acknowledged that as well.
There's no question about the record that there is a one-year statute in Panama?
No question.
For negligence?
No question. And negligence was the only case brought here in Colorado. Before I talk about the RTD factors, I'd like to go to Justice Coates' point very quickly. There has been no argument from the appellants in this case that the statutes could be harmonized. That was not an issue that was preserved. In fact, the Court of Appeals specifically says that the parties assume that the statutes are in conflict, because that's where the arguments went. So I don't think that's an issue that is before this court. I think there is a conflict. If there was no conflict, based upon the record that the case arose in Panama, the trial court decided it, and a one-year statute of limitations, this case is barred. So if there was no conflict and they could be harmonized, we wouldn't be here. I just wanted to mention that before going into the factors. The first factor that is that more recent statutes govern over older statutes. That's CRS 24206. Briefly, it provides that if statutes enacted at the same or different sessions of the General Assembly are irreconcilable, statute prevails, which is latest in effective date.
That doesn't work very well in this particular case, does it? Where you've got a very old statute that was abolished and then, for some reason, resurrected?
I think it does, Justice Mullarky.
Why?
And thank you for asking. There is Colorado law to the effect that a statute that is reenacted, in other words, it goes away and it doesn't even have to go away very long. But if you look at the Leninger versus City of Sheridan case, which is cited in our briefs, in that case, there were two statutes that dealt with a municipal jury demand and two different procedures. One procedure required the plaintiff to identify the number of jurors that was requesting. Those two statutes were both passed in 1970. In 1972, one of the statutes that required identification of the number of jurors the statute was repealed and reenacted. It really didn't go out of existence, but the legislature came back and made a new pronouncement that this is our intent. And so the court in Leninger, when saying these two statutes conflict, said we're going with the one where the legislature reenacted it, because that's the most recent.
Why is that terribly convincing? I mean, I just have difficulty with that application of that concept to these facts, because there was no change in the statute. It seemed to me that the idea that the more recent one prevails would take into consideration some sort of thought process, that this was reflective of a more recent policy decision by the legislature. And in this case, where it looks like you have just sort of an automatic resurrection, it's hard to see that there was any thought process that went into it.
Fair comment. Let me respond this way. If you listen to the legislative history, and I don't think the legislative history is dispositive, and I know this court knows that you look first to the statute, and the legislative history is the tail on the dog. I understand that. But the legislative history in 1984 specifically says, and I've listened to it, it specifically says the Uniform Conflict of Laws Limitation Act repeals the borrowing statute. In 1980s, and the statute was out of existence, couldn't be applied, and in fact, other courts that looked at it said it hasn't been applied. Just Judge Cain said that in Brown versus Union or Globe Union in 1987. It was out of existence for 2 years. In 1986, there was a comprehensive tort reform procedure which really dominated to a great degree the legislature. And if you that legislative history, I mean, there's a huge amount of legislative history on that. Not much on the statute.
Is there any on this resurrection?
Not on this statute, but you can look at the versions of the statute before, in 1984, and after. And the statute was actually clarified and improved by adding some language, and I can actually tell you what the language is if you'd like, because I've got it. So somebody didn't just pop this back in. This was part of a comprehensive tort reform package, frankly, in which the statutes of limitation were reduced. Negligence was reduced. Contract. Overall, in the Colorado Lawyer article written in August of 1986, talking about the fact the purpose here was to reduce the statute of limitations. And that act, as you may recall, was supported by a task force of the CBA, a task force appointed by the legislature. So I submit that to the extent there's nothing specific about this statute, but it was out of existence, repealed. It comes back with different language, not significantly different, but different language.
What? Could you just get your notes and tell me what you're talking about?
Essentially, when the statute was reenacted, language was added to it. The additional language was in that sentence, quote, in that state, territory, or foreign country, and then back to the regular text, by reason of lapse of time, and the added language, the cause of action shall not be maintained, unquote, in the state. I don't think it changed the intent or most of the substance of the statute, but it was clearly tweaked to make it clearer. It wouldn't have been tweaked to be clearer if somebody in one of those task forces in SB 69 hadn't said, this is important.
No, I'm just, yeah.
Well, what happened to the I'm sorry, I'll, just this one question, mm-hmm. But there's nothing, no reference made to the UPL, mm-hmm. Right?
None, Your Honor.
So that was just either not thought to be relevant or overlooked or something.
Or, as I would argue, I believe, and we're getting into different factors here between time and specificity, to say that in rare circumstances, and it's not every circumstance, but in a circumstance like this case, where a case clearly arose somewhere else, and it's not a messy case where the Colorado resident flew from Kansas, crashed in Nevada, and the plane was made in Washington. It's not a messy case. Where it's clearly arose somewhere else where the statute of limitations is clearly barred there, this is consistent with what happened in that activity in the legislature. The whole tort reform and the whole revision of our statute of limitations.
But counsel, isn't it rather difficult to argue that this was intentional, that the legislature clearly intended to, by implication, repeal the prior statute? I mean, if we know anything at all here, don't we know that there was a mistake made? The problem is we don't know what the mistake was. We don't know whether they failed to repeal or they reenacted an error.
Well, I think, Justice Martinez, this isn't about statutory repeal. I think what happened here is the court said there's a very narrow set of circumstances. In those set of circumstances, this statute should apply.
So you're reconciling these statutes?
I'm not reconciling statutes.
So you're saying that the borrowing statute is more specific and applies in a more narrow set of circumstances?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
Well, then, if that's the case, then why can't they be reconciled with the borrowing statute taking your narrow set of circumstances and the uniform code taking the rest?
Well, I think if you think of it as a set, first of all, I want to reference legislative intent. Legislative intent comes from the statute. Legislative history, as we know, sometimes it's complete, sometimes isn't. On Senate Bill 69, it's voluminous. But I can find references in that history to documents that don't exist. There are lots of, there are frankly gaps. This was back at a time when, even today, tapes don't work. I don't know if we've got everything there, because there isn't anything there about the legislative history of this, of borrowing statutes reenactment. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. What we know is that it was reenacted and the language was changed. It wasn't just accidentally by some computer error popped back in. So that's where I think legislative intent goes. So let's move to the second point. I believe the borrowing statute is more recent. I won't belabor that point. And I believe that under the Leninger case, that there's precedent in this court for that reenactment means new enactment. I believe that's the case. Turning now to the question of specificity, which I know this court is interested in. The UCLLA applies in three circumstances. Where the law of one other state applies, you apply that statute of limitations. Where the law of two states applies, you apply the general conflict of law rules of this state, which is the most significant relationship test. Of course, familiar with that. The third circumstance, it says, for all other claims, that's the exact language, the law of Colorado applies. So by its terms, the UCLA applies to everything. Every case can fall within that definition. The borrowing statute, on the other hand, only applies if two criteria are met. One, the case arose in another state. Two, under the laws of that other state or foreign country, the claim is barred. You've got to meet those two criteria. If you don't meet one or the other, the borrowing statute doesn't apply. So here, if the statute of limitations in Panama had been 3 years, the borrowing statute would be out the door. You might look at the UCLA to decide if the statute of limitations in Colorado would apply and to decide what law applies, but the UCLA doesn't go away. The UCLA still applies to all cases. That's what it says by its terms. So the borrowing statute, by its very nature, by its definition, in its reenacted form in 1986, is narrower than the UCLA. And Justice Martinez, you spoke to for judicial repeal. I don't think that by upholding the borrowing statute, you're repealing the UCLA in any way, shape, or form. There's frequent case law in this state where statutes are in conflict and you have to decide, based upon the RTD factors, which statute applies in this case. That's a statutory construction, and this court does it all the time. Sometimes, if one statute completely takes up the entire universe of what the other statute says, then perhaps judicial appeal is appropriate. And I think there was a 2000 case, City of Florence, versus Pepper. I think that was the case. That does happen. That's not the case here. You have different universes that the two statutes cover. So I don't think judicial repeal is an issue. One other reason that I think that the borrowing statute is more specific is, if you think about this case, where on the record before this court, we have a case that arose in Panama. It was determined by the trial court, has not been challenged. And you assume a one-year statute of limitation, again, which exists. This is the case where if, in fact, you say that the UCLA, the UCLA applies, essentially, you've made the borrowing statute obsolete. You've repealed the borrowing statute, even though that is the more recent statute. And conversely, if the borrowing statute applies, the UCLA, by its own terms, applies to all claims. It's bigger. It's got a bigger universe. You're not repealing that statute. So, to my way of thinking, because you have a subset, which is the borrowing statute, applies to specific claims, and looking at the specific record in this case, that's the statute that is more specific. Now, I want to go to another question, because this may be on the court's minds, and I'm gathering from the questions it may be. You've got two factors. The third one is the factor of last resort, which is take the longer statute of limitations. What happens if one of those factors doesn't apply? Or maybe there's one and one. That happened a lot in some of the case law, such as Voss, Dawson, Jones v. Cox, all that line of cases, because they all involve statute of limitations passed in 1986. There were conflicting sections of the statute of limitations period. And they were passed, and the specificity element wasn't there because they dealt with different classes of defendants versus different conduct. Okay. In this situation, we have a difference. We have statutes that are passed at different times. We have statutes that, one is more specific than the other. Even if you couldn't say that one was more specific than the other, I still believe that based upon the Leninger case cited in our briefs, Leninger versus City of Sheridan, based upon the fact that the Judge Kane in Brown versus Globe Union acknowledged that the borrowing statute was out of existence from 84 to 86, gone, didn't exist, that the borrowing statute is the more recent case. And I can't find any case in any of the briefs filed in which a more recent statute wasn't applied. And in fact, that has support in the statutes that we have, because in 24206, there is no qualification. It just says the more recent statute applies. In 24205, which says the more specific applies over the general, there is a qualification, and I'll refer to it. It says the more, essentially, the specific applies over the general unless the general provision is the later adoption and the manifest intent is that the general provision prevails. Therefore, CRS 24205, which is the specificity statute, is qualified. 24206, which says the more recent statute prevails, is unqualified. And I think that's significant here. I think it's significant, again, that there's no case we've got cited here in which an older statute is preferred over a newer statute because, as this court knows, the more recent statement by the legislature is the more present expression of intent. I'd like to get to a point that Mr. Peters raised, and this has to do with CRS 1382-106, which is the fairness exception, I think is what's referred to in the briefs. The problem with that argument for the appellants is that when you read that section, it provides that if a court determines that the limitation period of another state applicable under section 1382-104 and 1382-105 is substantially different, and then it goes on from there. There is a provision expressly in the statute that a condition precedent to analyzing 1382-106 is that 1382-104 applies. You have to make the prior determination that the UCLLA applies, and in this case, not the borrowing statute. Unless this court makes that decision up front, you don't get to this, to 1384-106. It's not an independent statute. It's a dependent statute. That's dependent on a prior determination by this court. Even if 1382-106 was an independent statute, which it isn't, the trial court said it wasn't, and the Court of Appeals said it wasn't, but even if it was, it's a catch-all. It applies to every case in which the law of the statute of limitations in a foreign jurisdiction applies, under the UCLA, borrowing statute, under anything. That, by its terms, makes it broader than the borrowing statute. Now, we've talked about legislative history. I'm not going to belabor it.
Well, would you tell me whether the law of negligence of Colorado applies to this case or the law of negligence of Panama?
The law of Colorado.
Okay.
The borrowing statute is by its nature procedural, not substantive. If the UCLLA applied, the purpose of the UCLLA is to take the substantive law of another state, which would include its statute of limitations. That's one step legal basis for the reason a conflict exists. Borrowing statutes, by their nature, are procedural. The UCLLA is substantive. And so if this case was brought in Colorado pursuant to the UCLA and this court reversed for prior courts, the law of Colorado would apply. As to legislative history, again, We've gone through the legislative history, and we believe it would be inappropriate for this court, without any legislative history as to why the borrowing statute was reinstated, to substitute its judgment for the specific language of the legislature.
Mr. Eismeyer, can I interrupt you right there 1 second?
Yes.
If we're going to get into legislative history, do you think it is significant that the borrowing statute was reenacted as part of a general project which began 2 years before the borrowing statute was ever repealed in the first place?
I think it is.
Does that suggest an ongoing project that didn't pick up the fact that during the course of the project, the statute was repealed?
I can understand your line of thinking. I don't think that's applicable here. When I listened to the legislative history, there were two different bills. One was 1153, one was Senate Bill 69. There were different provisions of these bills. The fact is, most bills that come into our legislature are thought about, in some cases, for years, decades in some cases. The no-fault law existed for years. It's gone. It may come back. So I understand what you're saying. The idea may have been there, but the legislative expression in terms of what the statute says was not during that two-year period. I think it's very hard for this court to make decisions based on ideas that sort of float in space or are bandied about, as opposed to what the legislature's would
well,
say.
I agree if we're talking about the language of the statute, but if you're going to get into us deciphering what the legislative history means because of these partial amendments, is it not also appropriate for us to consider the timing of the statute and the fact that it was presented largely as a package by an outside agency to the legislature?
I understand. Let me be clear. I said earlier I think legislative history is the tail on the dog. I do believe that. If this court wanted to elevate legislative history to the two statutory framework or the three factors in RTD, it would have added a fourth factor in RTD. Legislative history, for the most part, my reading of the cases, and I've read the cases in the briefs, justifies a conclusion that has already been reached. It does not lead to that conclusion. So I suppose from a philosophic point of view, I could make that argument, but I don't think it's relevant when we're construing legislative intent.
Let me ask you one more question about legislative history. In the past, we've usually talked about legislative history as being appropriate to consider once we found an ambiguity in a statute. Do you think the existence of irreconcilable statutes is the same as an ambiguity, and would that bring into play consideration of legislative history, or is that a separate problem that simply requires choice of preference rules?
I don't think legislative history, frankly, plays a part in this case, because the borrowing statute is not ambiguous in its language as written. UCLA is not ambiguous as written. I recognize there are conflicts, but this court has adopted three rules to resolve those conflicts. Legislative history isn't one of them.
Well, we adopted those rules.
I understand.
We changed the rules.
And I understand that, too.
I think the question that we're posing to you is, why not look at legislative history, since this appears to be something of a quagmire?
I understand. And if there was, I guess the question is, what is legislative history? And for the most part, legislative history is considered to be that which was brought to the legislature, which made the decision. It's not what went on in the minds of people at the CBA or in the public or in the lobbyists or so forth. It's what was presented to the Judiciary Committee, what was presented to the House, what was presented to the Senate. That's legislative history because it relates specifically to that. So in this case, Justice Coates, if you look at the legislative history regarding the borrowing statute, it was reenacted in 1986, there's nothing which says that it is anything other than what it is. The language speaks for itself, and it clearly applies to the facts of this case based on the record brought to this court.
Did you look at the legislative history of the enactment of the uniform law in 84, and what did you find?
Yes.
Did you find anything?
Yes. It was enacted to repeal the borrowing statute. It was enacted to create a substantive basis for choice of law as opposed to procedural. The legislative history is nowhere, is not particularly long. There is history in both the House and the Senate. It was designed to prevent forum shopping. which, as you know from the briefs, is the same basis, the same reason that the borrowing statute was adopted, to prevent forum shopping. The goal's the same. The difference between the borrowing statute is that it's procedural. The UCLLA is substantive. That's what the legislative history
And that's that, there you go, because 110 says basically the law of limitation in this state applies when the claim is substantive, which you said is negligence, which is 2 years.
Well, no, I'm sorry. If I did, I misspoke, because as I understand it, the borrowing statute is procedural in nature. It does not adopt the substantive law.
No, that's not what I'm saying. The conflict of law statute, 104, talks about if the claim is substantively based upon the law of one other state, the limitation period of that state applies. If the law of more than one state, then you sort it out. The limitation period of this state applies to all other claims. You just said earlier on that the substantive law here is negligence. Therefore, that last sentence says, in no uncertain terms, the limitation period of this state applies to all other claims. This is a negligence claim. The statute is 2 years. Right? That's very specific.
If you're looking at 1380.110. Okay.
1382.104, conflict
2104.
Of laws, limitation periods. The limitation period of this state applies to all other claims. So, all right?
Yes, but you have this court is making the initial determination. Do you look at the borrowing statute? Do you look at section 1382.104? Because they're irreconcilable, you have to decide which of those two statutes applies. Our argument is 1380.110 applies.
I know what your argument is, but the legislature here is talking about substantively based claims. If the substance of the action, i.e. negligence, depends on the law of another state, all right, you take the limitation period of that state. If it's based on the substantive claim of our state, negligence, the two-year statute applies, so there's uniformity, there's reliance, there's ability to develop your claim. This procedural argument you make never gets to the merits, cuts it off, it halves the uniform conflict, statutory period, for no apparent reason.
Well,
that, you know, if the legislature wanted to say that when they brought back the borrowing statute, then they would have repealed what they had done 2 years earlier, right?
True. On the other hand, the legislature has left 24206 on the book, which says the more recent statute applies. I mean, obviously the statutes are in conflict here. I understand what you're saying, and I agree that the UCLA is a substantive statute. The borrowing statute is procedural, and we've outlined that.
But these are our residents, these are our citizens in our forum, and people practicing in our forum would assume that if the substance is negligence, you've got 2 years to prepare your claim, do your research, prepare your claim. Not get ambushed by 1 year.
Well, right? If I may respond to this.
Yes.
First of all, the trial court considered both the UCLA and the borrowing statute in its decision. If you go back to the trial court opinion, and I would urge you to do so, you would see that the trial court said, under the borrowing, we think the borrowing statute applies. But the other test urged by the plaintiffs, which is the most significant relationship test, that's what the UCLA is. What's the most significant relationship between the two, between Panama and Colorado? The court's words were, the result is the same. That it looked at that issue. It ruled that the borrowing statute applies by its on space. That's what the court ruled. I guess my point is, the trial court even went beyond that and said that otherwise, even if the borrowing statute doesn't, the UCLA does. And it went on to say that the fairness exception here doesn't apply because the plaintiffs contacted the Panama, or wrote to Panama 7 months before the one-year statute of limitations ran. And in that opinion, they said at the very end, we don't reach the third argument, which is jurisdiction, indicating they did reach both the borrowing statute and the UCLA. So I believe, Justice Hobbs, the issue is when you have conflicting statutes, you're not going to get to this issue on 104 because the borrowing statute, based on the record here, has already
ultimately applied. What we're supposed to do here is to figure out the legislative intent and purpose.
Right. Yes.
And it's a very harsh result to throw out claims unless it's pretty clear that the legislature intended this, you know, they put it back on the books, this old statute, which really was the old one, that they really intended to repeal by implication what the plain words of the conflict of law statute says.
had the, just if I may respond.
Sure.
Had the legislature not changed the language, not hugely, but changed it.
Tell me again what that tweak was. What was the significant change when they reenacted the borrowing statute?
Well, I don't think it affects the import of the borrowing statute, but language was added. And I'll read this, and I will tell you what the language was. It's the way it used, it read, and I will just tell you when it was, it's the old statute. If a cause of action arises in another state or territory or in a foreign country, and by the laws thereof, an action thereon may not be maintained, now added language, in that state, territory, or foreign country, back to the old language, by reason of the lapse of time, back to the new language, cause of action shall not be maintained, back to the old language, in this state. My point isn't that this changed dramatically the meaning of it, or significantly, or that the old case law somehow doesn't matter. But somebody picked up this statute, added language to it. Somebody in the legislature presumed to have known what they did 2 years before as part of a comprehensive bill which shortened statute of limitations. So to the extent this is a harsh result, it would have been a harsh result to have shortened the statute of limitations, which is what SB 69
did. They didn't shorten the negligent statute of limitations, did they, in that reform?
Yes, I think they did.
From what to what?
In 1987, I think it was 6 years.
Okay, and they made it two.
Yes. And
they didn't make it one.
They did not make it one. On the other hand, there are plenty of states in the United States that have a one-year statute of limitations, so I would suggest that this is not something which is so unusual in the United States, even if it had been 1 year. That was one of the things that the court, or that the legislature did look at. But again, all we've got to go on is what this statute says coming out of 1986. The fact is, somebody picked the statute up, changed it, and reenacted it. And that's what we have. And that's why I think the court, that's why I think the court should uphold the Court of Appeals opinion. There's no more questions?
Thank you. They've stated in the brief that the legislative history is irrelevant in this case, but this case is all about legislative history. And the borrowing statute was initially enacted in 1921, as you've all acknowledged up here. The purpose is to prevent forum shopping by non-resident plaintiffs. It's not the case here. When UGLA was enacted in 1984 and the borrowing statute was repealed in 1984, the first part of the borrowing statute essentially was incorporated into the first part of UCLA. They both put limitations on, they both apply to cause of actions arising out of state where the limitation period is shorter and applying that limitation period. But the one thing they did in UCLA, and they never repealed this with the borrowing statute, is they had a specific exception. That specific exception is incorporated in 1382-106 to avoid unfair or unjust results, and this case happens to fall within that one exception. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank counsel for your arguments. Case stands submitted. The court will be in recess.